Hello and welcome to another exciting and jam-packed episode of Modern Day Philosophers. I hope you guys all had a great Thanksgiving. I did. I went to New York, spent it with my family. It was the second trip to New York in a span of 2 months. The first one was the one in which I did the interview you're going to hear today with Wyatt Cenac, who you may know as having been a correspondent on The Daily Show. He also wrote for King of the Hill. Very, very nice guy. And I got to go to his apartment, which was very cool, very hip. Very cool, hip neighborhood in Brooklyn. Very cool, hip apartment. And you'll hear more about that in a minute. Some people have been emailing me, what's going on with Last Comic Standing? Because they know I auditioned and it went well. Well, I had a call back in Los Angeles and I did the call back. And that went decently well. Not as well as New York, but decently well enough for me to maybe get my hopes up that something might happen. Until this headline came out. NBC is telling stand-ups to stand down. Last Comic Standing on hold. Nifty little headline, huh? Stand up, stand down. Last Comic Standing Season 9 is on hold to return for NBC's summer 2015 schedule. It is, as of right now, unknown as the show's format undergoes a revamp as to whether or not it will be on the air. So, there you have it. Never get your hopes up about anything, especially in show business, until you've done it and it's aired and you were in it. I think I've learned that the hard way many times. So there's your answer. I hope it happens. I hope a minute, and I'll keep you posted. Now, this week's episode is very special because one of the people who sponsored it is a listener, just like you, except the only difference is that they sponsored this episode, unless you yourself have been a sponsor of the show, in which I say thank you very much and much appreciated and needed and thank you and I love you. But this guy, he sent in, he said, how much would it be to sponsor an episode? I told him, I said, what do you want to promote? He said, nothing. I just want you to talk about the philosopher Boethius in one episode. So I put it in the hat, so to speak, full of all the names. And Alex, I said, listen, when we have somebody good to pair with Boethius, let's use him. And that was a few months before we did the interview. And then Wyatt came up and Alex said, I got somebody for Boethius. And he put them together. And that's this week's episode. So I hope you enjoy it. And this week's also brought to you by Dan Schlissel and Stand Up Records. Take it away, Dan.
Imagine a world where no one ever went hungry. Where you didn't have to choose between clean air and clean water. And where bitter, drunken comedians didn't have to work in small, dark clubs to tell you how severely screwed up everything is. If that kind of world scares you the way it scares us, then we can help. We're StandUpRecords.com. We offer the finest in CDs, DVDs, and merchandise from the best stand-up comedians on Earth. So please give generously. And remember, together we can't save the world. Yeah, no, we can't. So you may as well just buy something funny. That's StandUpRecords.com.
There you go. Go visit StandUp Records. Pick up my album, Some Kind of Comedian, while you're there, which will be available, by the way, on a limited vinyl run very soon. I'm excited. My record will actually be a record. And I've been record collecting since before it was cool, since it made me a weird kid. You know, since when it made me a weird kid. It made me a weird kid being a record collector before it was cool. You know what I'm trying to tell you here. Come on. I collected records as a kid. It was weird at the time. Cool now. And they were all destroyed in Hurricane Sandy, unfortunately. But on a brighter note, my album will be on vinyl. And I think we're doing only 100 of them. So let me know if you're interested in getting one and put you on a pre-reserve list or something. And you can have a signed record of my record. Or you can pick it up on CD or MP3. Go to StandUpRecords.com. Today, I want to thank the listener. His name is Lewis Kim, who brought you this episode along with Schlissel. Here it is, Boethius. I hope you enjoy it, Lewis, and thank you very much once again. And anybody else who wants to sponsor an episode for any reason, email me at thecomical@yahoo.com, or you could just go make a donation on moderndayphilosophers.net. $20 or more will get you a pair of Tweaked Audio earbuds sent to you as a thank you. Compliments of the people at Tweaked Audio. .com. Now, I also want to tell you one more thing. Alex Fossella, the man behind the scenes of this show, if you've been keeping track, has been making a web series called Racist Toaster, and it's finally up on the internet to watch. It already got nominated for 3 awards at the UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade. It is in categories of Best Title, Best Inanimate Object, and Best Villain. So hopefully he'll win some awards there. Go check it out yourself by going to youtube.com/myracisttoaster. Check out Alex's web series. All right, Without further ado, except for the intro song, of course, my talk with the wonderful Mr. Wyatt Cenac. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Been almost a year since I've been in New York.
Were you living in New York before, and then you just moved to LA?
I've been living in LA for like 2.5 years, but up until then I was in New York my whole life.
Yeah, I've found myself more stressed in LA.
But you kept the LA number.
Well, don't tell people my phone number.
I'm not gonna tell them your number, but
well, yeah, that's just out of ease. Like, it's at this point I've had that cell phone for over a decade, so
you don't want to change the number because of that.
Just in a weird way, it's strange to think how few phone numbers we know anymore. Like, as a kid, you know, you had to know your folks' number. You knew, like, maybe your grandmother's number. You knew the number for your friends, and you probably had like 10 phone numbers floating around in your head at any given time. And now I know my phone number, and that's really it.
Yeah. Do you think it's bad for the memory?
I was just reading something where they were saying that stuff is bad for your memory, that you shouldn't take as many photos when you're at events, that if you don't take the photo, you kind of force your brain to have to take a photo. So I mean, I don't know. That was just something I'd read. But it does feel like on some level we are outsourcing our memory to this little thing in our pocket. And then, the question is, okay, are we filling our memory with something else? Or is it just, now it's just empty real estate?
It's just dying on us.
Yeah.
You know, I find when I'm taking pictures, I'm not enjoying wherever I am. Because I'm like, oh, let me get a picture of it instead. And you become obsessed with having like a really good representation of a thing that you did, but you didn't participate in because you were too focused on getting that.
Yeah. Oh, the times I've been to concerts and seen all the phones just come out, and it feels strange because these aren't nice cameras. I mean, they're nice cameras for a cell phone. They're nice, yeah. Like, it's an impressive camera for a phone. It's not a Leica. It's the photo you're gonna get is not anything you're gonna print and put in a gallery. So it's weird that your eyes are the best way to capture this, and you're kind of saying, "Yeah, no, I'll go with something a little worse." And the sound quality is not that great.
Yeah, I always find that strange when people film a snippet of the concert, like, on their phone. When are you ever going to watch that?
Yeah. I mean, I always find it odd when people ask for photographs. And I'm fortunate. I don't get a ton of people that stop me for photographs, but I have friends who get stopped a lot. And it's always a strange experience because you're not having the experience with that person. You just have a photo of somebody that you stopped and you're going to post it to Facebook or show it to somebody, and everyone seeing it knows this person's not your friend. Like, you just accomplished something on a scavenger hunt list,
right?
Where you were like, oh, find a famous person, and then you took a photo with them.
Right.
And it's, I don't know, I always find that so strange because it seems like, wouldn't the better thing be to, and it kind of goes back to maybe what we were talking about a little bit earlier, but it feels like, wouldn't the better thing be if you saw Bill Murray in a bar and you were able to have an interesting 10-minute conversation with Bill Murray versus I just stopped Bill Murray and asked him for a photograph, and then I kept running.
And I think it's two things. I think it's one, people are afraid of having that conversation. Like, what if I can't? What if I sound like an idiot to Bill Murray? You know, I think there's definitely a fear when you meet someone who you respect or you respect their work. You're like, oh, I don't want to blow it with this person because this person, I mean nothing to them, but they mean so much to me.
I think there's definitely that. Yeah.
So I don't want to now mean something bad to them.
Right.
So let me just keep it quick and keep it neutral. Here's a photo. Yeah. I should.
I mean, I'm still bothering them.
Yeah.
they probably already resent me for bothering them while they're eating their meal. But if I'm going to bother them, let me do it.
Yeah.
Let me make it a mosquito bite. What's interesting about that, too, I feel like whenever I've had people stop me, even if they want to have a conversation, like they'll stop me and they'll ask me, you know, oh, what was it like being on The Daily Show? What was John like? You know, why'd you leave? All those questions. And I will generally answer your questions, but then I'll ask them about themselves. And I'm like, what do you do? And what's interesting is that people, to your point, they don't want to say. They're kind of like, they get freaked out. Like, why are you asking me questions? Like, and sometimes with that, I've had it happen where people have said, like, you don't want to know what I do. It's boring. And then there'll be a little bit of a register that goes on for them where they're like, oh, so it's boring for me to talk about myself and my job. Maybe it's boring for them to talk about his job. And
you think they're thinking that?
I think sometimes I've seen it happen, not all the time, but sometimes I've seen it happen where I'll ask somebody, oh, you know, tell me about yourself. And they're like, yeah, you don't want to know about me. It's just, I have a life. Like, I'm just a regular person. And then they're kind of like, oh, wait a minute. If I don't want to talk about myself, why would this person want to talk about themselves?
I feel like it's more likely that some sadness overcomes them. They go, oh, I get it. I'm boring.
I don't know. I think on some level we're all boring. We're all boring and we're all equally boring and fascinating. I
think the second reason people do it is just to check in with everyone and say, hey, see, this person's real. They exist right, in the real world. And you can actually go up to them. And
yeah.
It's kind of strange when you see somebody who's very, like, larger than life and you meet them in person. You're like, oh, my God, you're more than just an image on a screen. You're.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, is there anybody that you, if you met, you would fan out over?
Yeah, a few people.
Who's that?
Jim Carrey.
Okay.
Don Rickles.
Sure.
The Pope? No.
Sure, yeah.
Not
no,
the Pope. I, yeah. just, I just wanted to throw
no, you just wanna,
a wild card there.
Yeah, no, you want
a curveball, whatever.
That's for the that's for the TED Talk listeners. The cultured, your cultured fans to. They go, no, I read the newspapers.
Mike Myers would probably be the other one.
All right.
What about you? Anybody?
I don't know if I, like, there are definitely people that I've been fortunate enough to meet who I've been fans of. I don't know. There are people that I've met where maybe I wind up playing it too cool or something like that, but I just am like, oh, I'm not going to bother that person. And I like, it's very cool to be in the same space with them. But I'm not, this is somebody that, you know, I would rather have a real connection to. So I'm not going to bum rush them and, or I'm not going to ask them for a picture. I'll just sort of be in the space. And if organically we have a conversation, great.
That's a healthy approach.
I don't know. I guess so. I've never had that thing of oh, let me take this photo. And
even before you had acclaim in yourself and celebrity, you weren't like that even
no,
back then?
No, no. I don't think there was anybody. I mean, at that point, I became famous so young. So, that's not true. But I think when I first, the first famous person that I can think of that I met, I was in college. I was probably like 18 or 19. My cousin was the road manager for Outkast, and they at that point were the biggest music group to me. And so whenever they would come to North Carolina, where I was going to college, if they were doing shows nearby, my cousin would give me tickets and he'd invite me to come by the show, come by after the show backstage or, wherever they were staying and hang out with him. And so I would see Andre and I'd see Big Boy and we'd have little passing conversation of like, hey man. And there was one time when I think Big Boy wanted to go to a club in North Carolina. And so a bunch of us, we like tried to find a club, but we were all like the same age. So even though they were these big important figures for me as far as music, I also saw them as like, oh no, they're people. And that night when we tried to get Big Boy in to take him to a nightclub, we took him to a nightclub and they wouldn't let him in because he had on shorts and the nightclub had a strict dress code. And
they're so anti-shorts at these nightclubs.
Well, but to me, that was also one of those things. And maybe that's what did it for me.
It was an equalizer.
Yeah. Seeing that where it's like, oh yeah, if this dude who in my mind is one of the biggest musicians around can't get into this nightclub, and they know who he is, then yeah, he's got the same shit I've got. Like, right. It's like, just because more people know him, it still doesn't prevent him from like having to like he
still has to change.
Yeah, he's still got to put on pants.
Got to play by the rules.
Yeah.
He wasn't above of the no shorts policy.
No. Yeah. So I think that and I had interned at SNL around that same time, and then yeah, being around the cast members again, people who I admired and I saw in TV, and I was like, oh wow, these are all, really impressive people who I think are really funny. But at the same time, it was, oh no, these are people. And
When you were talking about the people that stop you on the street and ask you the questions, and you mentioned one of them was that people asked you, why'd you leave The Daily Show? It occurred to me that I don't know.
I just left because it was time. I felt like, you do something long enough, and I was very grateful for my time there, but at the same time, I found that I wanted to do more and I wanted to kind of take on more responsibility and sort of spread my wings a bit more creatively. And it just felt like my deal was up at the show, and it felt like, oh, well, this might be a good time to do that, to just branch out. And, the show as it is, it's a very time consuming gig. And I really loved the show and really tried to put as much time into it as I could. So doing that and then having these other interests, it's tough. I would write stand up and I'd hit the road on dark weeks. So like during this, when the show's on, it's like, oh, I'm there, and I'd have an idea for a joke and I'd be like, okay, well maybe on the weekend I'll work on it, or the next dark week I'll write. And yeah, dark weeks I would write furiously. And so
is it difficult to walk away from such a machine like that?
It's difficult in as much as, you know, I was there for 4.5 years and there's not a lot of turnover at that place, both in front of the camera and behind the scenes. So you get to know all these people and you see them every day. And so they become part of your life.
It's also very strange when you take a shift in your life and you basically say, all right, that part of my life is now a memory, you know?
Right.
I'm going into the next whatever it is. And for me anyway, there's a part of me that really wants to like plant my feet on the ground and be like, everything stay the same from now on, you know?
Yeah.
And it's never going to, and it's always changing, and it's tough to deal with that, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, consistency is, there's a security in consistency. And I think when you look at, you know, when I look at those people you hear about from, you know, like your grandparents' generation or maybe even your parents' generation, where it's like, so-and-so worked at the Ford Motor Company. They got a job right out of high school and they worked at Ford until the day they died. And yeah. Ford was good to us. And, you know, Ford pension put you through college. And
good working factory people.
Yeah.
Left me with this lovely wristwatch here.
Yeah. But there's something about that when you hear it that's like, oh, there is something kind of nice about the consistency of, oh, I've got a gig and this gig will never, ever end. And I don't have to worry about that I can budget my life accordingly, that I know that this is the base of what I'm going to get is every year I'm getting $40,000 and I'll maybe get a Christmas bonus.
No surprises.
No surprises.
But isn't that also kind of sad, though? Like,
well, and I think, but it is, and that's, I think that's the twofold thing is there's a security. It depends on how you look at it. I think if you knew that, okay, I make $40,000 every year, I'm going to get a holiday bonus every year, I'm going to get an incremental raise, but I know how much, I know the bare minimum of what I have is $40,000. I could play the lotto tomorrow and win $10,000, and now I'm up $10,000. If I budget accordingly, every year I could take a vacation, I could do this, or I could put this money and buy a boat or whatever. There's a certain amount of, I think on one level it could be disheartening to know that this is all there is, but there's the other part of it it's not that it's all there is, that's the bare minimum of what it is. You can make it something else, or you can do so much more within it. It's just up to you. And
security or excitement.
But I think you can get both. I think that's the,
I don't know.
To me, that feels like that's the, when people make the argument of like, you know, capitalism versus socialism, it is security versus the thrill. And I don't think that either situation is that sort of
black and white.
Yeah.
Well, you chose excitement over comfort in leaving The Daily Show, right?
On some level, yeah. I mean, I think it's, there was the, I had a secure thing for 4 years and 4.5 years, and then it was, okay, it's time to take a gamble on myself.
Gamble, excitement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that, I've always kind of done that. I think when I was at King of the Hill, it was sort of the same thing. I worked there for about 3 seasons and I saved up a bunch of money and kind of felt like, oh, I want to push beyond and try to spread my wings a little bit. And I want to try to not just write, but write and perform more and be seen as a performer as well as a writer. Okay, I'm going to leave. And then I ate shit for a while, and but then eventually kind of crawled out of that and
got
the next gig, got the Daily Show. And but it was like 3 years in between and a repo and a losing my apartment in the process. But wow. So leaving the Daily Show, I'm hoping it doesn't get to that point. I like my apartment. I don't want to lose another one.
It's a cool place. I mentioned when I walked in, it's got a kind of a Mad Men feel to it.
That's because there's a lot of scotch.
I didn't even notice all the scotch.
Yeah, there's a lot of...
I was talking about the old 50s furniture and everything. You know?
It comes with a lot of those bottles. If you buy enough Jameson, they give you a Lane vintage side table.
So that's how it works, the scotch first and then the furniture, not the other way around.
Yeah, you're kind of like, oh, I need some wood grain to, I've spilled some scotch. This doesn't spill well on Lucite. I need wood grain for this to soak
Let
into.
Let it absorb a little bit. Yeah. All right, well, let's take a look at your philosopher here.
All right.
Alex picked out
my philosopher as chosen by the Philosotron 5000.
Philosotron 5000.
Yeah, that's
we have chosen for you. That's a pretty terrible robot voice.
It is an awful robot voice. Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything. I was going to let you have it, but
I can do a better robot voice. But once you get started in a voice, it's hard to sort of like correct it. You have to sort of stop and try all over again.
Well, there's also the possibility that you go in and edit it and put in, you know, you could tweak it and put it through like a filter. And so I didn't know. I didn't want to shit on it until once you did, I felt okay with it. But it is a terrible robot voice.
Let me hear your robot voice.
All right. What's my robot voice?
This is my robot voice.
Oh, that is a better robot voice.
I don't know. Yeah. I think that's, robot voice kind of, it sounds a little less like a human.
Yeah.
Yours
was more electronic. It felt, I could feel the.
Well, that's also, I have robot parts.
Alex writes,
we're getting there.
Wyatt,
it's a little Orko. It's a little Orko from He-Man. But nobody knew what Orko was.
Wyatt went to Jesuit school, and the philosopher who he chose was a Roman Catholic, and his name is Boethius. Have you heard of Boethius?
No.
Me neither. We'll find out about him. First of all, can you tell me about Jesuit school?
I am not Catholic. That was one of the good schools in Dallas. So if you had a kid and you wanted them to go to college or to, like, it was a college prep school. So it was considered one of the more affordable, good college prep schools you could send a kid to. And so it was an all boys Catholic high school. We had to wear a uniform every day. The things I remember the most about it were that it felt very much like Animal House. Felt kind of like this place that was lost in time. In that my freshman year, so you would wear a blazer and it had the school patch on it. And then every Friday, the freshmen during lunch, we'd be in the cafeteria and the seniors would come in and they'd lock the cafeteria doors. And then they'd make all of the freshmen sing the school fight song and the alma mater. And if you couldn't do it, they might single a kid out and make them stand on the table and do a solo. And
Very aggressive choiring.
Oh yeah, no, it was. I mean, these were bullies. I mean, this was. You're talking about like, oh, freshmen, like whatever. Freshmen are 15-year-olds, 14, 15-year-olds, and like 18-year-olds telling them what to do, and they and everyone kind of turned a blind eye to it. And it was never terrible, but the seniors had their own courtyard, and the rule was no one's allowed in the senior courtyard but the seniors. And if you went into the senior courtyard as an underclassman and a senior caught you,
you'd have to sing.
No, they could do whatever they wanted to you. And so the old story that everyone had heard but no one could prove was, you know, oh, the year before there was a kid who went in the senior courtyard, and then the seniors that day they kidnapped him and they took him to the all-girls school. And they stripped him naked and they saran wrapped him to a tree. So he was just there at the all girls school naked. And
all the girls had their way with him.
No, that was not the part of the story. Okay, yeah, no. I think there would have been more people in the senior courtyard like, do something. We dare you.
How did it end?
No, it was just, it was that. I think that was enough for us to be like, oh my God, we can't do that. We're afraid to show girls our balls. And so so you didn't go in there, but it was, yeah. And like our homecoming, the freshmen would build chariots, and then there would be chariot races. And
really?
Certain seniors got to ride in the chariots. And so each homeroom, you were assigned seniors as big brothers. And they would kind of answer any questions for you and look out for you a little bit. And so during homecoming, your homeroom would build a chariot together. And then you would take one of your big brothers and you did these chariot races on the soccer field or and you would do that. And that was like those were the things I remember most about high school.
Do you remember the senior fight song?
No, I never had to sing it.
I've never even heard of a senior fight song. I didn't know there
was a school fight song. It was just like, but I never had to sing it because what I figured out and what became a much more fun game for me was I would see on Fridays when they were starting to shut the door and I would just run and I'd leave. And so it was always, can I eat my lunch fast enough to get out of singing the fight song? And every now and again, a senior would chase me with the intention of like bringing me back. And I was a fast kid, and so they could rarely catch me. But even when they caught me, I remember one time like a guy caught me and then like threw me against the locker and then was like, oh, I'm dragging you back there. And somehow I weaseled out. I was just too slippery. I was just like an oiled up pig that just kind of like just slipped out of his hands and then ran and hid on like some other side of the school until it was done.
I kind of love that the ultimate punishment is a solo.
Yeah.
This thing, it's like the bullies of Broadway.
Yeah, no, it was very weird. It was, but yeah, to me, I just enjoyed playing this like Tom and Jerry game of just, oh no, I'll run away and yeah, catch me if you can.
You better hit the high notes this time. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, no, it was very weird. It did, like I said, it definitely felt like a thing that, oh, that's a throwback to to like the 50s.
Yeah. What about the religious aspects of it?
I don't remember much of the religious aspects. I remember, you know, there was, they would offer, we'd have mass and they'd offer like confession and those types of things, but we all had to go to mass.
Mass is like massive prayer.
Yeah, it was.
That's how I think of it.
I think it was on Fridays. On Fridays, we'd have mass. And so it was the whole school, and we'd go into like the church that was on the grounds, and we'd go there and they would pray about something. Mm-hmm. And you know, I remember words like homily or something, you know, just like church words that and they'd do all that stuff, and then they'd send us on our way, and on whatever special Catholic days there would be things like mass services. And those, all I ever thought about those were, especially the ones on whatever like the Catholic holidays were, those I loved because it totally screwed up the rest of the school day. So you went to this thing for 45 minutes and then all of your classes had to be adjusted accordingly. So if mass went long, then you'd go to your next class and it'd only be 15 minutes. And it was like, oh, great. I don't have to go to math today.
Mass, less math.
Yeah, exactly. That was, if I'd run for a class office, that would have been my platform. So, yeah.
Were you raised with religion in your home? Or?
Not initially, but eventually, I think by the time we hit junior high, high school, my mother and my stepfather became more religious, and they joined a United Methodist Church, and we started having to go to church on a regular basis. Before then, we'd go like every now and again, and my only thought about church was that it was this thing that kept me from watching Voltron. Because that's on Sundays, like whatever channel, I think it was, you know, like at that time, I think it was maybe like USA would show like Voltron and like an episode or two of Voltron and Gem and some Hanna-Barbera cartoons. And I just loved animation. So I'd watch all of it. I'd watch Gem, I'd watch Voltron, I'd watch all the Hanna-Barbera cartoons. And yeah, when we had to go to church, it was, yeah, you can't. You can maybe watch a little bit of Voltron as you get changed. Mm-hmm. But then you're just sitting in this place and all you're thinking is like, what are those lions doing right now? Oh.
When you're a kid and you're, well, for me anyway, I was very into cartoons also.
Yeah.
And then when I would see regular television, I'd be like, oh, that's pretty boring. I don't know why anybody would want to watch that. It's not animated, you know? It was guys like Robin Williams and Jim Carrey that kind of bridged the gap for me, because they were like half human, half cartoon.
Right, yeah.
And then you were like, oh, okay, well, I can tolerate non-cartoon people, gets a little bit.
Right.
But yeah. But as a kid, you're like, you can't understand why anyone would, like, why is this TV full of non-cartoons? What are people torturing themselves for with, you know?
Yeah.
I thought we're supposed to escape all that. okay, well, anyway, let's go back to
Boethius.
Full name, and I'm going to try and pronounce this right. Anicius? Is that Anicius?
I'd go Anicius.
Anicius Manilius?
Manilius.
Manilius?
Yeah.
Anicius Manilius, a tongue twister. Anicius Manilius
Severinius?
Severinius
Boethius.
Boethius.
He's got a lot of IU in that name.
And that's why they just called him Boethius. They're that's a bit much. We'll call you Boethius.
Feels like they could have called him like four times Eus.
Boethius, okay? We'll go with Boethius. Yeah. He lived from, what does this mean? 480 to 524 or 25? They don't know. He might have lived until 525. They're not.
It was New Year's Eve. It was a big New Year's Eve accident.
It's like a whole year that he may or may not have been alive there. I mean, we're not sure about that year. He definitely wasn't very active in that year, if anything. He didn't make much of a mark between the year of 524 and 525 AD. He was a philosopher of the early 6th century. He was born in Rome to the ancient and prominent Anicia family. Anicia? I guess that's why his name was Anicius.
Sure.
Which included emperors Petronius Maximus and Olybrius? Olybrius?
That looks, yeah, it looks like Olybrius, yeah.
And many...
consuls. Sure.
What's consuls?
I think kind of like consultants.
Oh, okay. Like councils.
Yeah. I think I'm going to go. They're kind of like the lawyers of their time.
His father, Flavius. That's a cool name.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Flavius. Just somebody who was full of flavor. Flavius Manilius Boethius was consul in 487 after Odoacer disposed the last Western Roman emperor. Deposed, rather. After he deposed the last Western Roman emperor.
A deposing is like a disposal.
Right. So that's fine. Same thing. Yeah. They got rid of him one way or another. Boethius himself entered public life at a young age and was already a senator by the age of 25. He was consul in 510 in the kingdom of the Ostrogoths. I can't say any of these Roman words. The Ostrogoths. In 5,
those are like Austrian Goths. Ostrogoths.
Yeah, we're just gonna kind of sit back and watch everything happen.
We want to listen to Morrissey.
In 522, he saw his two sons become consuls. Boethius was imprisoned and eventually executed by King Theodoric the Great, who suspected him of conspiring with the Eastern Roman Empire. Because he wasn't so great, huh?
Yeah,
Boethius, anyway. While jailed, Boethius composed his Consolation of Philosophy, a philosophical treatise on fortune, death, and other issues. The Consolation became one of the most popular and influential works in the Middle Ages. Alex says, Boethius writes Consolation of Philosophy as a conversation between him and philosophy itself, personified as a woman. I like that.
All right.
I once read a poem where I made New York into a woman.
Did you?
Yeah, when I left New York. Okay. Then I realized too many people have kind of done that. But I just was like, New York, it's an abusive lover.
Right, yeah. So there was a common song, I Used to Love Her, that it's all about hip hop, but it's him talking about a woman that broke his heart.
Yeah, we tend to like make everything into a woman.
Yeah.
One point is the transitory nature of fortune. Internal virtue is the only true security for us because it is least susceptible to being wrecked by misfortunes. Internal virtue is the only security for us. It's funny because we were just talking about security versus excitement.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so maybe internal virtue. You can have an exciting life with internal virtue, and then you have both.
Yeah. Well, I guess on some level, it's if you think you'll be okay, then chances are you'll be okay. It's that notion of trusting in yourself, I guess. That, if you can find that, and if you can create that for yourself, then whatever challenges come before you, you're prepared, and yeah, you're not gonna freak out about it.
Is that what you do?
I don't know. I try, but I think that's one of those things. It's so much of an easier thing to say than to actually do. But I think on some level, I try to have some sense of faith in myself that, okay, yeah, I will somehow figure out a way to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
That may be why I feel okay leaving gigs after, you know, after some time to venture out on my own, is that I believe I can do this, so why don't I just go do it?
Are you a God believer?
In like specific gods or
any
Greek
god.
Gods, Norse gods. I'm not a religious person. I don't think I'm a very religious person. I haven't been to a church in a long time, or a temple, or a synagogue, or other places where people do God stuff. Even when I was younger, I've never seen myself as a religious person. I've been around a lot of it, but I think even thinking about it, it's always struck me as one of those things that whether there is a God or there is not, I think ultimately that God, if there is one, ostensibly just made a thing and walked away from it. I think, you know, and is observing it, but is not. I think whatever faith a person wants to have and whatever faith they want to put into their religion and their God, I think to me, the issue I've always had with it is if they put that of if they put it all on their religion and take no responsibility for it themselves, then they run the risk of it never happening. That, you know, what little religious stuff I feel like I recall is that God gave us free will. And I think that's maybe the bigger thing, is that, oh, if there is a God and God created us, well, yeah, he created us, and then he was kind of like, all right, now let's see where you go. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's necessarily about like, okay, well, every 5 years, okay, you guys are doing it wrong. Let me fucking put all the ants back in there in the right place, and let's start again. So, yeah.
Back to Boethius, he says, you can sustain a robbery with your virtue intact, even if your wallet is gone. All right, sure. So basically, it doesn't matter if you remove the material things, as long as it's what's inside, they can't steal, right?
Yeah, yeah. And probably, I would say, the idea that if you have two options. If someone were to steal your wallet, and you were to take all your time and energy to go hunt that person down and mete out justice, at some point, if that takes you 3 weeks or however long that takes you, you just spent 3 weeks doing that. Like, you're not the same person you were before your wallet got stolen. You've changed. You've become somebody different. And are you happy 3 weeks later at the person you've become, at, you know, the person who maybe just had a sort of single focus on trying to mete out justice? Is that, are, you know, versus the idea that, yeah, this sucks, but that's life. And
it's interesting in that we were talking about that kind of like planting your feet on the ground and just how things change. And I guess like the world around you, you can't control it's going to change.
Yeah.
But you can control what you believe inside and try and maintain what's important to you, you know? Yeah. He goes on to say, only if we lose virtue do we stop being people who can have a conversation with philosophy, and then we wind up going back to being animals. I mean, I think that's true. I think...
Yeah, I mean, I think I would call it empathy. It's our ability to be empathetic to other people that I think keeps us grounded. The more empathetic you are to another person's situation, the more reasonable you become as a person, the more connected you are to the world, that you recognize, okay, what I go through, someone else goes through similar, better, worse things, and I'm appreciative of that. The moment I stop, you're not affected by humans. I think that's the, I mean, it's always a strange thing to see, you know, I watch sports and a fair amount, and what is always both terrible but also heartening in sports is, you know, you'll see two teams playing in a stadium, and the stadium will overwhelmingly be in for one team, and maybe, you know, a player on the other team gets injured, and there is a collective hush that goes through the crowd, and when the player stands up, everyone claps, and then at some point they'll go back to being like, I hate your team.
Right, right.
But
there's a moment of humanity.
Yeah,
there.
But that moment, I feel like it shows that, okay, there is a collective appreciation for the human condition that exists, and the horrible thing would be if someone were to injure themselves and everyone just continued to cheer.
Right, then we'd be back in Rome with the gladiators. So maybe that's where we've come from then till now. We're like, all right, we still like the fight, but we're not. There's a little more humanity in it.
Yeah,
maybe.
I don't know. I mean, I hopefully. Feel like, but at the same time, I feel like you watch, like, I don't watch much UFC, but I feel like I see the way in which people get so excited on the notion of, like, finish him. And that, there's something about that feels very much like Roman gladiators of, you know, it's not enough to, at least in boxing, it's, oh, you're down for 10 seconds, this is over.
It's the culture within the sport, you know, that dictates the morality of the people watching
it. Yeah, but a sport where it's like, okay, you dropped this person to the ground, now get on top of them and beat them bloody.
Yeah, if they treated a baseball player like a hockey player, everyone would be outraged.
Right, yeah.
All right, let me read a little paragraph of his. He says, "If first you rid yourself of hope and fear, you have dismayed the tyrant's wrath. But whoever quakes in fear or hope, drifting and losing his mastery, has cast away his shield, has left his place, and binds the chain with which he will be bound." Oh, so he's taken that very chain that would have bound him, he's binding it. He's taken the control back.
Yeah, I mean, well, no, it sounds like he's saying, if you allow hope and fear to run your life, then you're limiting yourself. Whereas if you hope for nothing and you fear for nothing, then no one else can affect you.
I see. Yeah, then I see what you mean. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Then you're truly stronger, you know.
Yeah. I don't know if I guess I feel like we need hope. I don't feel like is a dirty word.
Yeah. What about fear? You need fear too, don't you?
Yeah. No, I think fear is I think those are both helpful things to have.
I don't know.
So the Philosotron 4000 is wrong. I disagree with both of you.
Philosophy overridden. Any better?
I like it. Yeah.
A little better? All right. Yeah. All right. You ready to do the quotes?
Let's do the quotes. "Good men seek happiness by the natural means of the virtues. Evil men, however, try to achieve the same goal by a variety of concupiscences. I think, evil people love concupiscences. They are big fans of a concupiscence.
Yeah. If there's one thing I know about evil people.
Yeah. No, it's, I think if you take some of the worst people in this world and, you know, when criminals get arrested and they go through their things, they find, you know, weapons, they find drugs, bags of money, but definitely loads of concupiscences.
Whenever they take evil people and they put them in a focus group and have them watch a show, they always say more can cup of senses.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
All right, let's go to the next one.
Yeah. The worst sort of misery is to have been happy. That's true. That actually reminds me of something that I think Louis C.K. had talked about. And I can't remember if he did it, if it was in an interview or if it was on stage, but just the notion of heartbreak. And it might have even been on his... Oh, it was, I think, in this past season. Maybe he even dealt with it there as well. But just that idea of to know, like, to have had your heart broken is kind of a wonderful thing, because you've seen happiness and it's wonderful, but it's also miserable, and know that misery and live in that misery, because then it will cause you to seek more happiness.
Better to have loved and lost, basically, than to have never loved.
Yeah,
loved and...
I could have gone with that, but I thought of Louis C.K.
Yeah, same thing, but yeah. you had a better example, maybe.
Let's see the next one. Nothing is miserable what is thought so, and contrariwise, every estate is happy if he that bears it be content.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. No, I think that's very, very true. That, yeah, even the you know, it's Citizen Kane, it's, you know, Rosebud, that, oh, you can have everything, but you're still just a little kid who fucking... You know, it's you still just want that same one little thing that you lost, and then you can find people who have nothing and are just have found a way to make nothing
work for them.
Something,
yeah.
And
happiness comes from within.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's true. It's yeah.
All right. Well, how do you feel? How do you feel about both of us here?
You know, there's some parts of both of us I like. I disagreed with him on the hope and fear thing, but I feel like he and I we agree on certain things, so I will let him advance to the next round. This is a reality show for philosophers, right? It's American Idol for Roman philosophers.
That would be cool. I'd like to see that show.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, your philosophy is it's a bit shit.
Yeah, no, that was so trite. That was
nobody's going with this guy's philosophy. You don't move on to the Hollywood. That's no. Wyatt, thanks so much for doing the show.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's about it then. I should get going.
Yeah, get out of my house.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, everybody. Thanks again to my guest, Wyatt Cenac. Thank you guys for tuning in. Thanks to Dan Schlissel over at Stand Up Records. Thanks to Lewis Kim. What a wonderful thing to have done. And thank you to everybody who's been donating to the show. It really keeps me alive, keeps me going, keeps the show going, and makes the world go round. So thank you for that. ModernDayPhilosophers.net is the website. You can make a donation of $20 or more. As a thank you, I'll send you some Tweaked Audio earbuds, compliments of the people at TweakedAudio.com. Please, if you have any time at all this week, jump on iTunes, click on the ratings and reviews section, leave the show 5 stars and a nice review. It really would help our presence on iTunes, and it would help grow the show, and it's very good. It's a good thing to do. It's very nice. And always, please email me and give me some feedback and say hello at thecomical@yahoo.com. All right, everybody, have a fantastic week, and I'll see you next time with another episode of Modern Day Philosophers. All right. Bye, everybody.